G'day, g'day, g'day. Welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 30th. My name's Dick Newman. I was just having a crack at the Facebook page the other day, the English History, Fact and Fiction podcast. You might recall I do a daily thing on there, This Day in History. Did a little thing about a princess, Ted II's daughter. Pretty sad story for the poor little thing. And it just made me think about these women in history. They really didn't cop a good time. And things haven't changed. I was just looking at the news and our brand new Hollywood princess is in trouble, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. She crossed her legs in public. I know what you're thinking. Shameless hussy. But that's the way for the modern royal family. There is absolutely no hint whatsoever of any sort of sexuality. If you're wondering how they make brand new royals, it goes like this. For example, with Wills and Kate, what happens is one morning, Wills has a boiled egg for breakfast while Kate has a sausage. 9 months later, we get a brand new prince or princess. And that's how it works. If you're listening to this and you happen to be a member of a royal family, I urge you to go back and re-listen the episode on King Edwig, where he had that threesome with his girlfriend and her mother. Happier times for him, and it could be happier times for you too. But for us today, it's all about Matilda, so we had better get on with it. Sampler there from Franz Liszt, his very famous Liebestraum. It was only a short sample because we've got a lot to get on with today. But on the other hand, now that I've had a little bit of Franz Liszt, I've just got to put this on for you. From the movie Listomania there back in, when was that? Crikey. I don't know. I can't remember. Roger Daltrey, Rick Wakeman, Ringo Starr was the Pope. Yeah, great days. And apparently teenage girls back in the day did scream for Franz Liszt. It wasn't the Beatles who created all that. It was Franz Liszt. Let's have a recap. Hank 1 got a dodgy eel sandwich and popped straight off to heaven. It was his nephew, Stephen of Blois, who got into the big chair first and scored the silly hat. This was despite nobles and churchy types swearing oaths not once, not twice, but three times that they would support Hank's daughter, the Empress Matilda, for the job. Stevie had a decent couple of years putting out little rebellions here and there in England and defeating the Scots. But the sources tell us that it's pretty lawless in England and not a very nice place to live. Steve didn't do quite so well in Normandy, where Matilda's man, Geoff Plantagenet, is fucking things up. Steve had that problem with the three bishops, and while we might look at it and say he acted appropriately, churchy types were pissed right off. Supporters of Matilda started to rebel, but where is Matilda and the support troops? Matilda and her half-brother Robert, the Earl formerly known as Gloucester, finally turn up, but with just a few guys. 140 knights, that's it. They're hoping to get a ton of support from the English nobles, but only a few turn out for them. The good news for Matilda is that the quality of the guys that turn out for her is quite good. Let's get back to 1140, where Steve has been besieging his little heart out. He'd built fortifications around Wallingford Castle and left guys there only to find that his guys got outflanked. He'd moved on to try out Trowbridge, and that's where we left him last week. So Stevie will continue to besiege Trowbridge, but it's not going well. He's got the support of his barons, but these guys just don't seem to want to put their backs into the job. It's half-hearted support that he's getting, and that's not good enough. So Steve will knock up something nearby and leave a garrison there. Just as well, because it's time for trouble in East Anglia. Rogo, that bishop who'd been arrested previously, had died the year before, but his nephew Nigel is still an angry ant. Nigel's missus had also given up his castle when Steve turned up with Nigel and threatened to hang him outside the walls. Nigel is busy spreading rebellion around Ely. We're back into Hereward the Wake territory, and this is a great spot for hiding rebel armies. But Stevie will get on the case, reading Billy the Bastard's secret diary, and then lashing boats together to form a kind of floating bridge. That's how you get round in Ely. Plus, he's going to have a quiet word with a monk who wouldn't mind a promotion to abbot and knows those secret pathways through the secret fens to the secret hideout. Stevie will do the surprise motherfuckers and take Nigel's knights. Nigel, like Hereward, will manage to sneak off, and it'll go okay for him. He'll get to Matilda, and from that safe position, he can get a letter off to the Pope, putting his cakes before the Pope can hear anything from Steve. Pope will issue a papal bull, ordering Nigel be restored, and eventually he will be, but only to get into more mischief later on. Miles of Gloucester, in the meantime, is expanding the rebels' territory a bit, and laying waste to the land, as you do. And we've done a deal in Cornwall between William Fitzrichard and Hank One's boy, Reginald Fitzroy. Reginald will take some of Stephen's castle, so Steve's now got to go to Cornwall to take them back, which he does. Now, you can't accuse this guy of lacking in energy. But it's no good. I take this, you take it back. I smash up your mate's lands, you smash up my mate's lands. There's no law and order, and both sides are spending a ton of cash on mercenaries. And some mercenaries are out of control, like one Robert Fitzhubert, particularly disliked because he boasts of roasting monks alive. Said to be related to that William of Ypres, he'll take a castle, but he's going to take it for himself, and he wants to be a serious player. He'll lose the castle and get hanged, but it's just not good stuff going on. William of Malmesbury tells us that we're back into simony. All things then became venal in England, and churches and abbeys were no longer secretly, but even publicly exposed to sale. Stevie will reduce the weight of the penny. Times are getting tough. Should we all get together for a nice cup of tea, some scones, and have a chat? Yes, we will. William of Malmesbury tells us, to this conference near Bath were sent on the part of the Empress, her brother Robert, and others of her friends. On the kings, the legate, the archbishop, and also the queen. But they wasted words and time to no purpose and departed without being able to conclude a peace. Nor was the ground of separation equal on both sides, as the empress, more inclined to justice, had declared that she was not adverse to the decision of the church. This last bit is the problem. The churchy guys wanted to draw up the terms of peace, and Steve says no. Probably a smart idea, because, well, he'd arrested those bishops. He's into simony, and the country is in a very bad state. Most of the religious guys didn't even turn up to this conference. The travel is just too dangerous. The churchy tops might not be behind our Steve. So, back to skirmishes, and on the part of Matilda's guys, burning the countryside and towns. People are reported to be burned alive while sheltering in churches. No idea why people still think going into a church will save them. They just burn as well as anything else. This is all crap, and we need a battle to sort it out. Everybody's been avoiding battle. At this stage, battles are just seen as too risky. A battle plan is good until the battle starts, then the plan's out the window, and we have to make it up as we go along. Now, that's no problem if you happen to be Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar, but we don't have one of those handy. Somebody could spook your troops, or somebody might just suddenly get reinforcements. And of course, in these civil-type wars, people can just suddenly change sides. But it has to come to a head, and it will by a series of unfortunate events. Lincoln is our place. Has a nice castle, it's a nice town, and nice countryside, so people want it. Have to say, this story is a bit confused, so here's my best go at it. We've got this angry aunt, one Ranulf of Chester. He's got Chester for fuck's sake, so why can't he be happy? But no, Ranulf was pissed off when Stevie sorted out that stuff with King David of Scotland by giving Dave's boy Hank an earldom. Ranulf thought he should have got that too. Anyway, Ranulf decides he will ambush young Hank, the Prince of Scotland, but Steve gets wind of the plan and escorts Hank to foil the plan. So Ranulf, who seems to be constantly pissed off, goes to visit Lincoln Castle. Just here for a couple of cold beers and a chat. Please don't frisk my obviously unarmed guys because you might find their concealed weapons. So he and his guys get in and will have a bloodless coup. Ranulph is in Lincoln Castle. Steve finds out and goes up to sort it out. And he says, okay, Ranulph, man, if you want it so bad, you can have it. This seems to be Steve looking to make sure Ranulph will stick to Team Steve. So, all good. No. Steve goes back to London, then he's pretty darn quick from the people of Lincoln that Ranulph is being a cunt. Can you get him out, please? Maybe, says Steve. How many guys has he got in the garrison? Bugger all. So, for some reason, Steve says, sure, and he's off to take Lincoln Castle. Now, maybe he was just pissed off that Ranulph hadn't put a decent garrison in to protect it from Matilda, or maybe, and I think this is unlikely, but maybe he just wanted to make life better for common people. No, it doesn't sound right, does it? The common people will just open the gate to the town for him and cheer him on as he arrests some knights who were just hanging around in pubs. But now Steve has to take the keep. Ranulph himself wasn't in at the time, but his missus is, and she turns out to be the daughter of Robert, the Earl formerly known as Gloucester. Ranulph's not happy with what's going on, so he's off to Matilda to see if she wants a miserable, angry dickhead on her team. Of course she does, Ranulph. Robert will get a sizable force together and march on Lincoln. Stevie may or may not have as many guys, but in either case, his advisers are saying, nick off home, Steve, and get more troops. Historians seem to think he had a smaller force, but in the speechy stuff, it seems that he's actually got a larger force. Could just be the bullshit in the speech to G up the team. But whatever the case, Steve is up for it. Perhaps he's just had enough and wants to get this stuff over and done with. 2nd of February, 1141. Would have been a bit cold for me. Ranulph of Chester and Robert, formerly known as the Earl of Gloucester, have just got their guys through a water course, which must have frozen the balls off, and onto dry land to line up. Ranulph and Robert have a heap of Welsh guys on their team. Pace have march of lords. Time for the speeches. Let's have a taster from Earl Angry Ant Ranulph addressing the troops. This comes just from Henry of Huntington. Since it is through me that you are called to encounter this peril, it is fitting that I should myself bear the brunt of it and be foremost in the attack on this faithless king who has broken the peace to which he is pledged. I have a strong presage that we shall put the king's troops to rout, trample underfoot his nobles, and strike himself with the sword. Yeah, good on you, Ranulph, man. Robert's turn. There is one thing, however, brave nobles and soldiers all, which I wish to impress on your minds. There is no possibility of retreat over the marshes which you have just crossed with difficulty. Here, therefore, you must either conquer or die, for there is no hope of safety in flight. The only choice that remains is to open a way to the city with your swords. If my mind conjectures truly, as flee you cannot, by God's help you will this day triumph. Yeah, not really Shakespeare's marvellous speech that gives Hank 5 at Agincourt, but it'll do. Robert will then slag off some of the king's men. He might like this, so I'll toss it in. There is Alan of Brittany in arms against us, nay, against God himself. A man so execrable, so polluted with every sort of wickedness, that his equal in crime cannot be found, who never lost an opportunity of doing evil, and who would think it his deepest disgrace if anyone else could put in comparison with him for cruelty. Then we have opposed to us the Earl Mellant, perfidious, whose heart is naturally imbued with dishonesty, his tongue with fraud, his bearing with cowardice, vainglorious in temper and boastful in words. He is pusillanimous in deeds, slow in advance, quick in retreat, the last in fight, the first in flight. Next we have against us Earl Hugh, who not only makes light of his breach of fealty against the Empress, but has perjured himself most patently a second time, affirming that King Henry conferred the crown on Stephen, and that the king's daughter abdicated in his favour, and this man considers fraud to be a virtue, and perjury to be admired. Then we have the Earl of Albemarle, a man consistent with his wicked courses, prompt to embark them, incapable of relinquishing them, from whom his wife was compelled to become a fugitive on account of his intolerable filthiness. The Earl also marches against us, who carried off the Countess just named, a most flagrant adulterer, a most eminent bawd, a slave to Bacchus, but no friend to Mars, redolent of wine, indolent in war. With him comes Simon, Earl of Northampton, who never acts but talks, who never gives but promises, who thinks that when he has said a thing, he has done it, when he has promised he has performed. Hitherto I have said nothing of that runaway William de Ypres, for words have not yet been found to describe fitly the wiles and crooked paths of his treasons, and the disgusting loathsomeness of his impurities. So of the rest of Stephen's nobles, they are like their king, practised in robbery, rapacious for plunder, steeped in blood, and all alike tainted with perjury. You brave nobles, whom the late king exalted, this Stephen has humbled. Whom the one has raised, the other has ruined. Rouse yourselves, and relying on your valour, nay, rather on God's justice, take the vengeance which he offers you on these iniquitous men, and gain for yourselves and your posterity the immortal renown. If you are of one mind in executing the divine judgment, swear to advance, execrate retreat, and in token of it, unanimously raise your hands to heaven. Yeah, now that's going to get the mob going. Lock him up. Lock him up. Yeah, well done, Robert. Steve, on the other hand, he either had stage fright or there's something going on with his voice. It's said that he spoke very quietly. So he'll get Alan of Brittany or Baldwin Fitzgilbert, depending on your source, to do the speechifying. But first he was keen to get God on his side, so let's have a bishop, or perhaps we shouldn't have got a bishop in. Henry of Huntingdon tells us, meanwhile King Stephen, in much tribulation of mind, heard Mass celebrated with great devotion, but as he placed in the hands of the Bishop Alexander the taper of wax, the usual royal offering, it broke, betokening the rupture of the king's. The pyx, also, which contained Christ's body, snapped its fastening and fell on the altar while the bishop was celebrating, a sign of the king's fall from power. Yeah, sorry, should have said spoiler words there, shouldn't I? God's actually spoken already, but we've got to have a battle. Steve will set up his troops. Knights will dismount, but he'll keep some cavalry. Front and centre will be Steve. Can't say he lacks the balls for battle. Does seem, though, that Steve has that smaller force. Henry of Huntingdon tells us this is the fault of his feckless earls who failed to bring many guides with them. Now, this could be right, because we've already heard that the earls weren't putting their backs into this stuff for Steve. Let's have a taster of Baldwin's speech. The power of Earl Robert is well known, but it is his custom to threaten much and do little. With the mouth of a lion and the heart of a hare, he is loud in talk but dull in action. The Earl of Chester is a man of reckless audacity, ready for a plot, not to be depended on in carrying it out. Rash in battles, careless of danger, with designs beyond his power, aiming at impossibilities, having few steady followers, but collecting a confused multitude. There is nothing to be feared from him. None of his undertakings prosper. He is either defeated in battle, or, if by any chance he obtains victory, his losses are greater than those of the conquered. Yes, yeah, suck on that, Bob and Ranulph. And it'll go on to say that Bob and Ranulph should have bought more of their treacherous earls so that they could be dealt with here and now. Then he finishes up with, lift your hearts and stretch out your hands, soldiers, exultingly to take the prey which God himself offers you. Yeah. No, God's already spoken, mate. Spoke to Stevie. Broke the taper. Now, having given you those speeches, I've got to say, how did the Welsh understand? Because Robert of Gloucester was probably speaking in Norman, and they're Welsh. But I guess you've just got to give those speeches, haven't you? Henry of Huntingdon tells us that even before he finished his speech, Bobby's armies were blowing trumpets, yelling, and the ground was trembling under the advance of the army.
Look at your young men fighting. Look at your women crying. Look at your young men dying. The way they've always done before.
A little bit of Guns N' Roses Civil War to get us in the mood for battle. The battle's going to be very brief. Steve's mounted guys, led on one side by William of Ypres and on the other side by Alan of Brittany, attacked the Welsh forces, which are on the left and right flanks of Bobby's army. Now, that's no contest, mounted armoured guys versus poorly armed and unarmoured Welsh. We'll see the Welsh run away as fast as they can. But neither of those two mounted forces retain cohesion. Again, it's the problem with the bigger horses, the heavier armour. You can't really duck and weave. Archers pelt into them, and then Ranulf with his mounted guys can chase off William of Ypres. And a similar thing will happen on the other side, with Alan of Brittany also running away. Henry of Huntington tells us that if William of Ypres does a runner, then he knows the battle's lost. He's not a coward, and he's one of the smartest military guys around, so he just knows that fighting will be no good if you're not going to win. Henry will tell us, thus all the king's horse fled, and with them William of Ypres, who had ranked as an earl and was a valiant soldier, but as an experienced general, perceiving the impossibility of supporting the king, he deferred his aid for better times. King Stephen, therefore, with his infantry, stood alone in the midst of the enemy. Yeah, not looking good for Steve, and according to William of Malmesbury, all his earls had left him. The earls, to a man, for six of them had entered the conflict together with the king, consulted their safety by flight. A few barons of laudable fidelity and valour who would not desert him, even in his necessity, were made captive. So Steve's lost his cavalry, and now Bob's forces are pressing in on three sides. Steve is said to have been ferocious, whacked guys so hard that he broke his sword. Somebody passed him an axe, whacked a guy so hard with the axe that he broke the axe as well. Somebody on Bobby's team comes up with a plan. Belt Steve's poor old head with a rock. Steve will go down and his men will run away. Apparently about 500 drowned in the river while they're trying to escape, and that's more casualties than the guys that died in the battle. So once again we see that running away can be even more deadly than being in an actual battle. But Bob's got Steve, and Steve can go into the slammer at Bristol. Don't fret too much for Steve, he isn't in a dungeon. It's more like house arrest and a promise not to escape. But William of Malmesbury will tell us, it was reported that having either eluded or bribed his keepers, he had been found more than once beyond the appointed limits, more especially in the night time. He was confined with fetters. Yeah, so Steve's had a couple of goes at wandering off, so, yeah, chains. That's what's going to happen. Now, what about the ordinary people of Lincoln, you ask? All were therefore slain or surrendered. The city was given up to plunder according to the laws of war, the king having been conducted to it in miserable plight. So those ordinary people, once again, cop a flogging. The king's lost the battle. We're in medieval times, so we know that that is the will of the big angry sky monster. So a whole lot of nobles will now turn to Team Matilda. They think that Steve is in the slammer and won't be let out unless he is either dead or so old that it won't matter. Alan of Brittany will fight on. He'll have a crack at ambushing Ranulf of Chester, but it won't work and Ranulf will actually capture Alan. Then he'll introduce Alan to his best boy in the torture department, who will tickle up Alan until he pays homage to Ranulf and hands over his lands. Steve's son-in-law will hold out at his castle for a while, but get turned out and banished. And the odd noble here and there who remain loyal to Stephen will also get the boot. William of Ypres will head to Kent for the best beer in England and to hang out with Steve's Mrs. Matilda of Boulogne. So Kent is still Team Steve. Over in Normandy, things are looking grim for Steve and great for Geoff of Anjou, who can now tell nobles, hey, look, my missus is now in charge of England. The guys in Normandy, like England, see this as God has spoken and put Steve in the slammer, and he's unlikely to get out. So they'll start having friendly chats with Geoff. Time for Matilda to come out and play, and she needs to meet the churchy types to confirm all this God's will stuff. What better churchy type than Steve's brother Hank, and let's have a meeting at Winchester where Hank has his bishopric. Makes sense. And of course, Matilda knows the way to a bishop's heart. William of Malmesbury tells us, the Empress swore and pledged her faith to the bishop that all matters of importance in England, and especially the bestowing of bishoprics and abbeys, should await his decision, if he with the Holy Church would receive her as sovereign and observe perpetual fidelity towards her. Ye great great start, Matilda. But for me, it's all a bit like play acting. Everybody promises that they'll be good, and then once they get the silly hat, all that shit's out the window. Hank the Bishop has to play his part now. Nor did the Bishop hesitate to receive the Empress as sovereign of England, and together with certain of his party to pledge his faith that so long as she did not infringe the covenant, he would observe his fidelity to her. So it's all going very well there. Next day, we'll have a nice ceremony in Winchester Cathedral. Not yet the cathedral that you go to today. The final cathedral is in the shape of a sort of cross. Billy Rufus built sort of that horizontal part of the cross. Matilda gets the keys to the treasury, and in the treasury is a silly hat, but she can't put it on just yet. It's got to be the Archbishop of Canterbury. Bishop Hank will get Theobald of Bec, who is the Archbishop of Canterbury, to Winchester. Theobald says, "Hang on a minute, I swore to Steve, and I can't just ditch the poor bugger. I might need to have a chat with him first." So no popping on the silly hat just yet for Matilda. Steve will tell him that, "Yeah, you can break your oath." Seems that Steve can see the writing on the wall. He knows that God has spoken. A delegation of Londoners will visit Winchester and ask for Steve to be released. Matilda says no, and she'll put a couple of extra chains on Steve for good measure.
"Chains, my baby's got me locked up in chains, and they ain't the kind that you can see."
No, sorry, Fab Four. These are definitely the sort of chains that you can see and feel. Hank the Bishop will get lots of his churchy mates there, including our dear old William of Malmesbury. He's actually going to be there. Big shout out from all of us here at English History Fact and Fiction to William of Malmesbury. Love your work, man. Yeah, so they're all there for a big old churchy conference. And it's all going very well. Hank will do a real number on his brother Steve, saying what a turd of a king he turned out to be. He'll bang on again and again about the arrest of the three bishops. Matilda gets introduced to the citizens of Winchester as Sovereign, or Lady of England, something like that for now, but still no silly hat. Time to head up to London. We know now that's the second thing you need to do after getting Winchester and the Treasury to rule England. It's all very good. Every town they go through, people turn out to cheer. That's what we want. But is it all peace, love and lentils? Not according to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Now was England more disturbed than before, and all evil was in the land. Yeah, you can't settle lawlessness overnight. It takes time. But for Matilda, she's got Winchester and the Treasury. She's got the churchy guys on side. She's made a triumphal procession to London. All she needs is London on side, and then it will be the big chair and silly hat for Matilda. What could possibly go wrong? Well, yeah. Let's start with a big fat tax. Probably not a deal breaker in itself. Everybody expects a big fat tax. But it's the collection method that might be the deal breaker. Steve was doing that commune thing for London. Great for merchants, great for trade. A commune sorts out its own taxes. But Matilda is demanding the tax directly, which says that London can go and fuck itself over its desires to be a commune. Wealthy London types say, "Look, sorry, we're a bit broke. We just had to finance the war for Steve." Matilda will hit the roof and tear them all brand new arseholes. Not going well for our Londoners. But surely Hank of Blois, the Bishop of Winchester, must be happy with his choice. No, he's been making representations on behalf of his nephew, Steve and Matilda of Boulogne's little boy Eustace, saying Eustace is a good kiddie. He should be able to inherit some of his dad's lands. Big fat no from Empress Matilda. Plus, Dave, the King of Scotland, has his eye on some lad for Bishop of Durham. Local churchy guys say no. Empress Matilda says yes. So much for a promise not to interfere with churchy appointments. William of Malmesbury tells us, "But behold, at the very moment when she imagined she should get possession of all England, everything was changed." And look, she's fucked up, hasn't she? She's fucked up. You're supposed to promise all the good stuff, get the big chair, the silly hat, and then you go back on all your promises. You don't do it before you get the silly hat. I don't know. Matilda, what are you doing? Okay, Matilda of Boulogne, Stevie's wife, has got nothing to lose by now. She and William of Ypres will raise a force in Kent and march on London, burning and pillaging. Londoners, perhaps still pissed off about the tax and the no-commune deal, will side with Matilda of Boulogne. Fair enough. Empress Matilda managed to nick off. She'll head to Oxford. Matilda of Boulogne will be warmly received in London. Londoners are definitely on Team Steve. Hank Bishop of Winchester will also return to Team Steve. No London, Winchester in doubt, churchy support in doubt, no silly hat for Empress Matilda. And then she came to London, and the citizens would have seized her, but she fled with much loss. That's from the Chronicle. Matilda needs to go back to step one, secure Winchester and the treasury. Now, Winchester's got two castles. One is the King's Castle and one is the Bishop's Castle. Henry the Bishop will get to Winchester first, secure his castle and besiege the King's Castle. Empress Matilda and Robert will turn up. As they go through the front gate, Henry the Bishop will nick off out the back gate. They get the King's Castle and start besieging the Bishop's Castle. The Bishop's Castle is called Wolseley, and if you have a look at it today, it was largely built by this very Hank of Blois, the Bishop of Winchester. Time for Matilda of Boulogne and William of Ypres to turn up. So the besiegers of the Bishop's Castle become the besieged of the town, the Chronicle tells us. But when they were at that place, Stephen's Queen brought up her strength and besieged them till there was so great a famine in town they could endure it no longer. Yeah, starved the buggers out. Then they stole out, and the besiegers were aware of them and followed them, and they took Robert the Earl of Gloucester and led him to Rochester and imprisoned him there, and the Empress fled into a monastery. That's the shorthand version of events. Henry the Bishop had ordered some of his men inside the town to start burning stuff. William of Malmesbury tells us, in the meanwhile, combustibles were hurled from the Bishop's Castle on the houses of the townspeople, who, as I have said, rather wished success to the Empress than the Bishop, which caught and then burned the whole abbey of nuns within the city, and the monastery, which is called Hyde Without the Walls. Yeah, setting fire to stuff. Yeah, off we go. Plus, Matilda of Boulogne's guys were setting fire to buildings as well. Meanwhile, Matilda of Boulogne is getting reinforcements and supplies from London, while Empress Matilda is inside getting hungry. Empress Matilda's guys will garrison in a church, which Matilda of Boulogne's guys set fire to. It's all pretty nasty, and time to get the fuck out of there. Now, Empress Matilda has got some guys up in Werewolf, about 10 miles up the road. They're garrisoned in a church, and they're about to create an incident. Looking back, it looks like they might have done this deliberately to create a diversion. So some of Matilda of Boulogne's guys are going to go up there to sort it out. Easy peasy, just set fire to the church. The leader of Matilda's mob up there will lose his eyes when the church is set fire and the roof falls down. But diversion created. Time to get out of Winchester. Robert, whose current status is back to Earl of Gloucester, sends Matilda out first. She will ride in the male fashion, whatever next. And she'll travel at speed, while Robert thinks that running away is not for earls, so he will travel nice and sedately. And he'll find himself captured and in the slammer at Rochester Castle. William of Malmesbury tells us, the earl's immediately pursuing him as he thought it disgraceful and beneath his dignity to fly, and was the chief object of universal attack, he was made captive. Dickhead. Or, if you prefer, he bravely sacrificed himself so Matilda could get away. With Matilda was Dave the Scotsman, who was apparently captured 3 times on the way, but escaped every time, and Miles, Earl of Hereford, who escaped by ditching his armour to look a bit common. Dave the Scotsman, by the way, that's King David of Scotland. So Matilda's got Steve as a prisoner, while other Matilda has got Bob as a prisoner. Can William of Malmesbury sort this problem out for us? At last the affair was decided that the king and himself should be liberated on equal terms, no condition being proposed except that each might defend his party to the utmost of his abilities as before. Oh, fuck it. Looks like Empress Matilda's big shot at the big chair is a dud. But let's not forget the ordinary citizens of Winchester. These people had been helping Matilda of Boulogne's efforts to take the city. So Matilda of Boulogne will say, thanks in the usual way, let her troops ransack the place, houses, shops, churches, whatever. Yeah, it's great, isn't it? Medieval prisoner swap takes place. Steve heads out to Bristol, leaving his missus and a couple of nobles behind. He gets to Winchester, and Bobby is set free, leaving his son behind. Bobby gets back to Bristol, then all hostages are set free. All very civilised, but we're back to square fucking one in this. Steve is king again, but Matilda and Bobby have control over various lands in England, and after Lincoln, not all the nobles are rushing back to Steve. Hank the Bishop is back on Steve's team and has to do some explaining. He seems pretty darn good with the words, so all good with him. 1142, Empress Matilda will set up a new base at Oxford. Her guys will fortify around the place, but not much is going to happen for a while. Steve is ill, perhaps due to his imprisonment, and Matilda is exhausted after the Winchester stuff, so they'll all agree to a bit of a truce. Matilda can send a message to a man, Geoff of Anjou. Help needed. Geoff will write back and say, look, I'll talk to Bobby if he wants to come over and have a chat, but don't be annoying and send messengers. I don't want to talk to them. Yeah, thanks for fuck all, Geoff. Bob will go to Normandy. Now, this is a dangerous journey, but desperate times call for desperate measures. He'll get himself to Cayenne, and Geoff will say, look, I'd love to come and help, but I've got castles right here that need to be taken. But don't take that as a no, Bobby, so just hang around a bit, will you? So Bob will help Geoff take 10 castles. After that, Geoff says, look, man, sorry, no can do. But hey, take my dear little chap Hank with you. Everybody will want to fight for him. So Geoff and Matilda's boy, Henry Plantagenet, who'd be about 8 or 9 at this stage, he's about to get his first trip to England. Maybe we should have a quick look at the name Plantagenet. It goes back to a guy, Count Geoffrey Greymantle, lived around the 930s, or born around the 930s. So Count Geoffrey Greymantle of Anjou married a local beauty instead of a political asset. Now, this is always a bit dodgy, because if you marry a woman for love instead of politics, it must be some evil spirit in her that lured you from the path of politics. Mind you, she is a descendant of the King of France on one side and Charlemagne on the other, so good bloodline for your family. Geoffrey did understand political marriage, as it was this very Geoffrey Greymantle who married off his 45-year-old sister to the 15-year-old Louis V, which ended that Carolingian line in France because 15-year-old Louis V wasn't getting it up for Geoff's 45-year-old sister. Anyway, let's get back to the hot chick evil spirit. She is one Adele of Moo, and she is going to get a big promotion from evil spirit to daughter of Satan. Adele wasn't fussed on the churchy stuff and nicked off early every time, but here's a story from olden days. Always absent from mass at the consecration of the host, she was one day forced by her husband to see the rite. She flew screaming out of a window and vanished, proof of her demonic origin. Of course she's not the daughter of fucking Satan. The story seems to have come about from two things. First, Geoff and his descendants were all pretty much successful, and they were all noted for having a very bad temper. So, successful angry people, yeah, you must have had the help of the devil. The name Plantagenet was not in common use during this period. It was actually our Geoffrey of Anjou, husband to Empress Matilda, who scored it as a nickname. Seems to relate to a yellow flowering shrub known as the common broom. And we're going to have to wait until Dick III for a king to actually claim the name Plantagenet. And we'll have to wait to the late 17th century for historians to refer to Hank II and the mob that come after him by that name. Let's get back to England. Steve is feeling much better, thank you. So he's off to knock over some of these here new castles that Empress Matilda put up without the appropriate council approvals. 29th of September, 1142, and Steve is at the gates of Oxford. He doesn't particularly want to take Oxford, he just wants Matilda, and not in a good way. No kissing cousin stuff here.
Well, I've got a gal, she's as cute as she can be. She's a distant cousin, but she's not too distant with me. Kiss all night, I sleep, squeeze her tight, but we're kissing cousin, that's what makes it alright.
Oh, that Elvis is such a naughty boy, isn't he? We've got Steve and his guys outside the fortifications with a river between them and Oxford. Some of the defenders wander outside the gate. Bad idea, perhaps they don't understand siege warfare. Steve will see his chance and charge across the river. Luckily for Steve, his guys follow and they get in the town. He can then besiege the castle. 3 months later, and the people inside the castle are getting a bit peckish. Oh, for a nice cup of tea and some scones. Jam on top, cream on top, that no longer matters. We just want the scone with jam and cream. Or perhaps we'd settle for some Saracen buttocks partly roasted. Plus, we can see big siege weapons coming into town. Things are getting grim for Team Matilda. Brian Fitzcount is hanging around nearby, but he's not attacking. We have to guess he just hasn't got enough men. But according to William and Malmesbury, it was that they weren't going to attack Steve inside Oxford because they knew what a great job that Robert of Gloucester had done previously on internal defences. I'm not sure if I can go along with that because it didn't seem to stop Steve knocking it over. But here comes Robert of Gloucester with young Prince Hank to save the day. And they got 300 knights, so Jeff has provided something. But not to get ahead of myself, they are still at sea and safe landing spots are a bit thin on the ground. Robert will head to Wareham, which Steve had just taken back in this back and forth bloody war. Robert will take Wareham. They aren't up for a fight so soon after the last one. So they do the chivalrous thing of the time. That is, they're allowed to send a messenger to Steve saying, "We need your help. Come by this date or we'll surrender." Now, Steve ain't falling for it. He has to get Matilda. He's staying at Oxford. Robert, meantime, won't head directly to Oxford. He'll take a couple of more towns, then hold a conference to discuss plans for, well, the taking of Oxford. Meanwhile, Empress Matilda has taken matters into her own hands and escaped. Stevie will be cross. Frustratingly for us, it is here where our dear William of Malmesbury puts down his word processor and just kind of stops. He tells us that the guys in Oxford were starting to sneak off rather than wait around to see if Robert of Gloucester turns up. And those on guard may be looking outward for signs of Robert turning up rather than keeping an eye on the keep. William of Malmesbury leaves us with a promise that he'll be back to write more, but he won't be back. William will die the following year. So please raise a glass tonight to our dearly departed William of Malmesbury, and thanks, mate, for all those ripping yarns that you gave us. We're also just about at the end of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. There's only one last quote I've got for you, but it won't be for a few years yet. The Chronicle condenses the next few years down to one paragraph. It's like the current chronicler just wants to give us the précis of the current period. Henry of Huntington is also getting old, but we've got a few more years to get out of him yet. But this isn't getting Matilda out of the castle. The story is rather famous, and it usually starts with her climbing down a rope, but it could be that she just got out by a gate. The rope story's better. Matilda had just 4 nights with her to sneak past Steve's troops. By this time, the river is frozen, so it can be a stroll over the river. Matilda and her guys were said to have been dressed all in white so as to blend with the snow. Then it's just a matter of a 16-mile walk in the snow at night to Abingdon, where they can get some horses and hot-foot it down to Wallingford and safety. Now, I have to say, good on you, Matilda. I'd say England in the middle of fucking winter at night time, 16-mile walk in the snow, I'd lie down after about 100 yards and say, "Oh, just leave me. Just leave me. I'm fucked." So good on you, Matilda. That was a bloody big effort. Mind you, if we got in a TARDIS, we might find that she was being piggybacked by knights. Garrison at Oxford will now just surrender to Steve. Nice finish to the year for the lad. He can now go to Wilton for some R&R with his good buddy William Martell. But Robert the Earl, sometimes known as Gloucester, will head there too and we'll have another battle. Unfortunately, we don't have William of Malmesbury to tell us all about it and have just a few details. It seems that the two sides were evenly matched in numbers. But Robert is the better general, and he got to do the surprise motherfucker around sunset. Steve's team will be defeated, but Steve will escape this time. His mate William Martell will fight a rearguard action, which will prevent Robert's forces from riding after Steve, and Martell will get himself captured. But Steve will do the unthinkable and give up a castle for his release. Perhaps like Paul Manafort, in a year or so, he'll get a presidential pardon. Big points to Robert and all this, and much embarrassment for Steve the King. 11:43, and we're back into that I take your castle, you take mine sort of stuff. Things are going nowhere. But Geoff of Anjou is doing okay in Normandy, so there's that. There's a big story in 11:43 that historians like. This one is about Geoffrey de Mandeville. This Jeff had a dad, William, who was head turnkey at the Tower of London, but somebody or other had escaped back in Hank One's time. Hank One imposed a heavy fine on William and took possession of his lands, so Jeff was noble but a bit broke. When Steve got in, Jeff had sworn to him to get his land back, and about a year later, Steve gave him his manors back. So all good. When Matilda looked like she was getting the top job, she gave him the head turnkey job at the Tower and forgave the fine that her dad had put on his dad. So even better deal, and so now Jeff is on Team Matilda. But Steve's back. So Jeff goes back to Team Steve, but something will go wrong. Perhaps he's sending sweetheart letters to Matilda just to inquire what else she might like to give him if he swaps back to her team, but we'll never know for sure. Seems like a reasonable proposition. He's a magnet, so he just wants more, 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 more. Steve will arrest him, but he'll do it badly. Henry of Huntingdon has this. The same year, the king arrested Godfrey de Manville in his court at St. Albans, an act more fitting the earl's deserts than public right, more expedient than just. But if he had not taken the step, the king would have been driven from the throne. Now, the problem in this is that Steve had invited Jeff to court, and you don't arrest nobles who are attending your court. It's very sloppy, and the noble equivalent of arresting bishops. Not a good look at all, Steve. Jeff will hand his castles and the Tower of London back to Steve. Not happy about it, but it's hand over your castles and I'll let you go, or don't hand over your castles and I will hang you and just take them. Jeff hands them over, then nicks off to start getting his stuff back. This is the problem for Steve. In normal times, you can just get up your nobles and they have to take it. But with a viable alternative for the big job hanging around, you just join the rebellion. You might think that Steve should have just hung Jeff anyway and taken back his castles. But believe it or not, killing a noble, even if you are the king, is a big deal. Jeff hadn't actually done anything wrong. And Steve has already botched up the arrest and will have to do some explaining to the nobles on that. Killing Jeff could just tip a few more over to Team Matilda. Jeff will start smashing stuff up in East Anglia, nicking baby Jesus stuff, burning towns, whatever, but only the places loyal to Steve. Jeff will do it guerrilla style, so Steve can't find the guy and bring him to battle. Jeff will now do a Herald with the Wake and get into the fens at Ely, and Steve can build a big beautiful wall. Or maybe a series of castles rather than a big beautiful wall to block Ely from London. Jeff will ride out to one of the castles that Steve is having built. It's a nice warm day, so helmet off, dickhead. Some guy in the castle will pick up a crossbow for a pot shot, and Jeff takes a crossbow bolt to the head. Should have listened to his mum, because I would almost guarantee you that his mum would have said, "Jeff, whenever you ride out to anything, you keep your helmet on." There's no coming back from a crossbow bolt to your head, but it'll take a week for him to die. No burial for Jeff, he's been excommunicated. This is a big deal for Steve. The rebels are in the west, and Jeff had just started a new rebellion in the east. With Jeff out of the way, he's back to having just one front to fight. And Steve will cop another break when Miles of Gloucester, one of Matilda's key guys, will have a, well, fatal hunting accident. That happens. Nothing dodgy in this one. He had also recently been excommunicated, so we all know that God did this one. Bloody God. But wait, there's more. Bishop Henry, Steve's brother, had a falling out with Steve's treasurer. The treasurer contacts Team Matilda, saying, "If you send help, perhaps I can get your Winchester back." Team Matilda will send a mercenary. All good, and we can rub our hands together with glee. But it won't work. The treasurer has a missus who fancies that big, strong mercenary type. They will chain up the treasurer and bang to their heart's content. The mercenary will now declare for Team Steve and settle down to his nice bit of crumpet. And then he'll die of some awful stomach disorder. Pretty sure that's God again. But maybe God is playing both sides. Steve is off to Lincoln because that runoff of Chester has taken Lincoln again in the War of Ping Pong. Steve had his guys start working on siege engines, but one will collapse and kill 80 of his men. Now that is definitely an act of God. So Steve's off home again. This sort of stuff is just going to continue for a couple of years. Team Matilda are starting to impose laws in the west and south in the areas that they control. So we can see that she is pretty entrenched there if she's making laws. 1145, we'll see perhaps a major incident. Robert the Earl, frequently known as Gloucester, will give permission to his boy Phil to build a castle in Farringdon. Steve, of course, gets wind of this and thinks it's a bad idea. So he's going to head up to Farringdon and start building a counter castle. But while Steve's building his castle, he will have his guys attacking Phil, and he'll do quite well. Phil will send a message that he's up for a chat, and in that chat, he will submit to Steve. Ungrateful little shit. Morale for Team Steve is up, and some of the rebels will follow Phil's example and submit. Henry of Huntingdon tells us, after daily assaults on the castle, while Earl Robert and his adherents were, with great resolution, waiting for fresh forces not far from the king's army, the castle was taken with much slaughter. At this time, the king's fortune began to change for the better. Steve's morale is up, but apart from that, it will continue to be that tit-for-tat war all around the place, so we may not be quite so optimistic for Steve as Henry was. No outcome is in sight. And we need to move on to 1146. 1146 will start promisingly for Steve. Ranulph, Earl of Chester, by now has pretty large land holdings. He wants a hand against the Welsh in the north of Wales. Robert of Gloucester and his mates have got stuff in the south of Wales. So Ranulph will do a deal with Steve for support against the northern Welsh. Ranulph will do his bit by helping out in the taking of Bedford and supplying 300 knights for an attempt on Wallingford. Steve's turn now to help out Ranulph, but Steve's guys are in his ear. You can't leave the country. Travelling through Ranulph's land could be a ploy for an ambush. Fucking Ranulph hasn't been paying taxes. Wales is a dangerous place. There's no scones there. All that sort of shit. Steve will say, okay, I'll ask Ranulph for hostages. What the fuck, says Ranulph? You don't trust me. Well, personally, I wouldn't trust Ranulph, but also, I wouldn't put him into a dungeon in chains, which is what Steve fucking did.
I'm in chains. I'm in chains.
Yeah, thanks, Tina. Steve's reputation is in the toilet with Donald Trump's. Once again, he has a noble in his court. This noble's been helping him out. And it was Steve who's reneged on the deal, and Steve's locked him up. Henry of Huntingdon tells us, afterwards, however, when the Earl came peaceably to attend the King's Court at Northampton, fearing nothing of the sort, he was arrested and kept prisoner till he gave up the strong castle of Lincoln, as well as other castles that belonged to him. The Earl was set free to go where he pleased. William of Newburgh was a bit harsher. He tells us of Steve. He forgot his royal dignity and honour. It was an infamous deed. Ranulph gets out of the slammer because Steve's nobles are calling for his release. They do not like this shit where anybody can get arrested, particularly if you get arrested for doing the right thing. Ranulph's going over to Team Steve was probably the low point for Matilda in this whole drawn-out sorry saga. His return will be a huge morale boost, and Ranulph will go berko, attacking castles, building his own castles, and keeping Steve very busy. Could have all been avoided. But Steve has learned his lesson. No, he hasn't. He's going to arrest Ranulph's nephew and demand his castles. There's another one now for Team Matilda. At the end of the day, Team Steve will have more wins over the next couple of years than Team Matilda. Both sides are getting harsher with captured nobles. That's what happens in war. We start off nicely following international rules of warfare, but once we get frustrated, then it's out with the chemical weapons, nukes. Civilians suddenly mean nothing. War is crap, and everyone's over it. Even our chroniclers go quiet. They're over it too. While things are getting nastier, they're also getting tired, and warfare slackens. Matilda has lost some of her main supporters, including her half-brother Robert, the now deceased Earl of Gloucester. Matilda is about stuffed. She's over it, and will go back to Normandy, never to return to England. But Team Matilda now gets a new OIC. I present to you young Henry Plantagenet. Matilda gives him all her rights. Well, thanks, Mum. I get to inherit a stupid war. But she isn't quite out of the picture yet, and we will return to Matilda later. We now have Team Hank, younger generation, and things are a bit different now than when Matilda started. Steve has been defeated in Normandy, and that is pretty much the big difference. He's a loser there and hasn't been able to get the final victory in England. He might be down, but he's not out. And I think that's where we might leave it this week. We've got Stephen down but not out. But on the other hand, we've got the fresh new prince of, well, yeah, England. I suppose. Next week, we can see how it goes for Team Hank. Plus, we'll follow up on Matilda, see how it goes for her. And we're also going to meet another strong, powerful woman, oddly enough named Matilda. You'd never have guessed that, would you? Another Matilda. But that's for next week. Before I go, just a quick update, this time on the Anglican Church in Australia. The Anglican Church has had a bit of a problem for quite a while. They are a bit like the Catholics, except that their priests can marry. And back in the 80s, they decided that marriage between a man and a woman was no longer for life, so divorce was allowed. They then allowed female priests in some areas. There's part of the Anglican Church that is still very, very conservative, and they won't allow female priests. They've now jumped in on the same-sex marriage thing, and they've come down very harshly on same-sex marriages. For a start, you can't get a same-sex wedding in the Anglican Church. Yeah, and that's okay. I don't mind that. But they're also saying that none of their officials, if you like, are allowed to attend same-sex marriages anywhere. Same-sex marriage isn't allowed on any of their properties, and they've got properties other than churches, you know, they've got all sorts of buildings. So they're just coming down very harshly. And it's not going down that well with all of their priests. Some of their priests are sort of going against this, saying, no, no, look, it's a law and we should welcome these people and so on. Personally, I don't care. I just don't care at all, because it is just another nail in the coffin of their religion, so far as I'm concerned. And I think nails in coffins of religions is a good thing. These conservative guys are currently, where I am in space and time, in Jerusalem, of all places, having a big powwow. And it's not going that well, not only with Australian members of their church, but also Irish members of their church are having a bit of a yell and scream, saying, you know, look, you guys are just homophobic and you need to get into the real world. So we'll see how that goes. Yeah, once again, not really a drum solo, but last week I did that little bit of The Who to feature Keith Moon, and I thought to myself, what if, Dick, what if Ian Pace listens to this podcast? He will surely be pissed off that I've not featured his drumming. So that was a little bit of Deep Purple to get us into some historical fiction. This week it is Ken Follett, The Pillars of the Earth. Now, it's been a long time since I read it, and I did see it on TV. They made a mini-series out of it. Now, this Ken Follett is very popular. Having said that, there are a number of people who don't like his stuff. One of the reasons I really like it is because there's a fair bit of business and finance in it, and my background is business and finance, so I really enjoy that stuff. But apart from the business and finance, I still think it's a ripping yarn. The main part of the story is about the building of a cathedral in the fictional town of Kingsbridge. So it's set in about the time that we're talking, the time known as the Anarchy, where Stephen and Matilda are battling around. Now, he did write a sequel, but the sequel's kind of set about 100-something years later. It's a big book. It'll keep you going for quite a while. I thoroughly recommend it. Ken Follett, Pillars of the Earth. So it's just a matter of what we go out with. I know, hang on, just before we go, time for a quick update on Archbishop Philip Wilson in Australia. He was found guilty and it was down to sentencing. Now, if you're going to sentence somebody like an archbishop, generally what you look to do is give them a suspended sentence. It goes like this. I sentence you to a couple of years in the slammer, but you look like a decent sort of a digger, and you've said you're sorry, so what we're going to do is let you get on with your life, and if you're not naughty in that couple of years, well, all good, off you go. If you are naughty in that couple of years, well, we're going to put you in the slammer. So what the court's looking for you to do is to say, look, sorry, I've made a total cunt of myself, and I promise not to do it ever, ever again. didn't happen. Archbishop Wilson did not say, "I am sorry." In this case, the magistrate did not give Archbishop Wilson a suspended sentence. In sentencing, the magistrate, Robert Stone, said, "There is no remorse or contrition showed by the offender." So Archbishop Wilson's position is the magic staff and protecting pedophile priests is way more important than looking after kiddies. So, of course, we could all agree with that magistrate saying no suspended sentence here. So it's a matter of whether he's going to get imprisonment or home detention. The disappointing bit in all this is the failure to show remorse. And, of course, we're dealing with the magic stuff, which is really difficult for us non-magic people to understand, particularly when you think back. Like in an earlier episode, we said it was the Irish priest that said, "Look, this confession should all be private. It should not be public." So the early church, it was all public. Make them wear a cloth sack and bag them on a Sunday, whatever it was. And it just goes to show, like, the rules that the magic guys set, they are constantly changing. It's all stupid. And ultimately, if they're not there to protect children, what the fuck are they there for? So if you're Irish, could you please speak to your magic guys and say, "Look, you guys got it all wrong. Back in the dark ages, it needs to be out in the public." In the meantime, Archbishop Wilson has, of course, appealed. So the thing's not totally settled. We'll see how it goes. I don't think he's going to win his appeal. I think he's done. We just got a little taster of Deep Purple back there with The Mule. That's from their album Fireball. Fireball wasn't that popular for Deep Purple, unless your name is Dick Newman, because Dick Newman thought it was fucking brilliant. So we'll go out with a little bit of Fools from the same album. Hope to see you next week. Bye.